parry the next attack, to disrupt the next skill. Rylan Silverblade stabbed forward with his scimitars. Ed managed to parry one, but the other struck his shoulder, next to his neck, and bit into his flesh in a spot unprotected by his armor. Burning pain spread across his body as rivulets of blood tinted red the bas-reliefs of his breastplate, and his mind snapped into a sharp focus. He punched Ryland's blank face with his black hand and wrenched a rank of endurance out of the hero in an almost visible rip and tear of dark aura. It left a familiar taste in Ed's mouth, as if somehow he recognized it from somewhere.
"There's something living inside that thing,"
Ed noticed as he pushed forward and slashed at the automaton's face, leaving a line of fractures across the hero's skin. Lisa used Holy Carapace to create a protective, sand-like layer of second armor around Ed, who could feel his pledge interacting with it and improving it even further, making him into a damn living tank. It would come in handy against Rylan's normal attacks, but he needed to be careful against his skills, which specialized in avoiding armor. The rogue darted to the side and tried to eviscerate Ed's guts, but Mark came out of nowhere and activated his taunt, forcing everyone in a small area around him to face him instead. That included both Ed and Rylan. At first, Ed tried to resist the compulsion, but he realized it was faster if he simply worked together with his friend. He faced the dwarf and rushed him while Ryan tried to dart away from the dwarf, which he couldn't attack. Ed jumped at the fighter, planted both feet on the dwarf's chest, and pushed hard to propel himself like a dungeon lord bullet against the rogue as he thrust his sword forward with all his strength. He aimed at Rylan's chest, hoping to pierce it enough for his sword's anti-magic enchantment to trigger. At the last second, Rylan shadow-stepped, only to reappear right next to Ed. Both scimitars struck at the dungeon lord mid-air, fracturing his golden carapace and sending him crashing against the ground. Ed rolled away and jumped to his feet, shaking his head and trying to clear his mind. He and the rogue circled each other, with Lisa's cleric and Mark's fighter to each side.
"They can't directly attack each other," Ed realized then.
Ivalice Online didn't allow heroes to target one another. They had been using skills that didn't need a target. Bull Rush was a movement skill, and Stormwind was an area of effect spell. Lisa and Mark weren't in a fight for their lives like he was. They were playing a game under a specific set of conditions never intended by the developers. They needed to keep a boss alive long enough for him to deliver a killing blow against a hero, while at the same time not being allowed to attack said hero themselves. The militant church would have forced them to log out long ago, but thankfully, the laptop they would have used was now in the Haunt's possession, and the man trained for the job by the summoned hero was now dead. Even then, if the fight dragged out, the risk that someone back in Halagese or Galtia would figure out how to eject his friends from the game increased. Ed was aware the laptop wasn't the only computing equipment the militant church had, and the summoned hero had probably trained more than one person in its use.
"We need to end this," Ed thought.
But if he destroyed Rylan too soon, the hero would just teleport away. If Ed waited for his friends to activate the jamming tower, Rylan would self-destruct. The only way to capture the hero was for Ed to run him through with his anti-magic sword after the jamming tower was powered on. He could feel that his minions had finished capturing the charcoal tower in the distance. Alder, Levy, and Kess had to be there, readying the jamming dish. Would Ed and them be able to coordinate at exactly the right time? Just like Mark and Lisa, he too was playing a game with a very specific handicap. Sure, he could destroy Rylan and try to capture some other hero another time, but he needed to defeat the rogue. The very core of his being demanded it. This fight was more than a battle to the death. Ed had something to prove, to himself and to the rest of the world. The card in his pocket showed a future that would never come to pass. The alternatives of the Shadow Tarot, the Wraith and the Tyrant, would not do. The only way forward was to challenge the odds and create a new path, like unlocking a secret ending in a video game storyline. The Dungeon Lord alone wasn't strong enough to achieve that ending. He'd gone down to Silverblade's attack just like so many others before him. But Ed was alive, and not because of a hidden Dungeon Lord's power he'd unlocked all of a sudden, or a burst of determination, or the Dark's intervention. He was alive only because back on Earth,
Before the mantle, and the dungeons, and the otherworldly powers, he'd spent many nights having a good time playing video games with his friends. Friends who liked him enough that, when forced to choose between siding with him or their asshole boss, they'd gone with Ed, even with their jobs on the line. It was humbling, and it went against everything Ed thought he'd learned so far. For a long time now, Ed thought that as he increased in experience points and furthered his path as a dungeon lord, he was becoming stronger than the helpless young man he'd been back on Earth. Tonight was the first time he realized some part of him may have actually gotten weaker. Hadn't killing been coming easier to him lately? Would Lisa and Mark have liked the man he was now, if they had met him today for the first time? Ed had needed to don the name of Lord Wraith just to survive in a cruel, unknown world. But surviving wasn't enough. All the other dungeon lords had survived, for a while, and then they'd lost, and Lord Wraith wasn't any different. Ed was playing to win. And now, he wondered if the ace in his sleeve had been there, all along, waiting for him to claim it. Like a sort of heritage. Perhaps, by aligning his two different personas, Dungeon Lord and Nerdy IT Guy, he'd find the strength to forge the path to his secret ending. Both hands, black bone and human skin, closed tightly around the handle of his sword. He had a plan, but even though he had had a bit of practice before, it would be extremely risky. He could feel his body shivering at the memory of the scimitar piercing his chest, the animal part of his brain screaming against the possibility of experimenting that kind of pain again, begging for him to turn tail and run. Ed forced that sensation down and steeled his will like a warrior honing his blade before battle, until there existed nothing else but that moment, the surrounding heroes, with Rylan's Silverblade squaring up against him. The trembling stopped. Since he'd taken running out as an option, his entire being prepared to fight.
"Hey, Ryan! Are you listening over there? Your combo is off cooldown already, so quit wasting my time," he taunted the rogue, unaware if Ryan was reading his words through his computer monitor back on Earth. There was a small chance he was. Ryan loved to interrupt the final boss's speeches, but something told Ed that Ryan would listen to him, if only because of their mutual hatred.
"You know, the problem with you is that you've always been a lazy player," Ed said as he lowered his guard on purpose, goading the hero further. "That combo of yours? You stole it from other players as soon as you stumbled across the forums and have been using it ever since. The problem is, you're a one-trick pony. Back when we played together, if you used your combo and failed, Mark, Lisa, and I were stuck getting your ass out of trouble. No one's coming to save you this time. Have you thought about what's going to happen if you cycle through all your cooldowns and I'm still standing?"
The Dungeon Lord grinned.
"Well, that's when I get to teach you how to play this damn game at last."
The rogue's scimitars flashed purple, and he rushed at Ed, fast and silent. The cleric and the fighter charged after him, trying to interrupt Rylan's path, but Ed went after him, holding his sword in front of him as if offering the tip of the blade for Rylan to impale himself into. Instead, the rogue activated Shadow Strike and disappeared in a flash of purple light. In less than a second, he'd reappear exactly in the Dungeon Lord's blind spot. So, Ed activated his dungeon vision, using the charcoal tower that oversaw the plaza, and which was part of Undercity's new dungeon, as the focal point. In an instant, his field of view shot upward over the battlefield at dizzying speeds. But Ed was used to the sensation and expected it. He kept his footing as the blood and the bodies came into focus. His few remaining creatures and minions fought against the last dredges of heroic opposition in the plaza. He saw the griffin flying away, and the dozens, if not hundreds, of fresh heroes eager for action coming from Ulysses Heights. And then he focused the vision, so it showed the surrounding area, just in time for Rylan Silverblade to appear exactly behind Ed's back, scimitars already tearing through the air in a double horizontal slash meant to cut Ed's neck in a single strike. Except that the Dungeon Lord saw it all, and using his improved reflexes he arched his back and thrust his sword behind his head as if preparing for a heavy downward slash. Instead, He saw from his vantage point, high above, how the tip of his flaming blade struck against Rylan Silverblade's face right between the eyes. He felt a resistance like clay breaking and heard it shatter like glass as his sword pushed through. The scimitar attack went wide and hacked at Ed's carapace, vaporizing it without damaging the Dungeon Lord. Still under the effects of improved reflexes, Ed turned to face the recoiling rogue, drew his sword out, and punched hard at the crater that marred its charred and broken head, stealing another rank of endurance as he struck. The hero recoiled, its movements less human and more mechanical by the second. He was about to counterattack when Mark bullrushed him again and the both of them struck a dilapidated wall, collapsing it and showering the automatons in a rain of debris. Ed adjusted his dungeon vision. Rylan stood, his body covered in superficial fractures. The fighter, who had suffered an enormous amount of damage from that point-blank enhanced fireball, stayed down, trying to heal.
"That was lesson number one at how not to suck at the game," Ed told the rogue. Now he was sure Ryan was listening. "After lesson two, you aren't getting back up."
Flavie had thought that her life in the haunt had prepared her to be ready for anything, but the battle unfolding in front of her was on an entirely different level. The air was so thick with static that she could barely breathe, and the black clouds above had broken into a checkered pattern that revealed parts of the night sky. She was aware, theoretically, of what that specific phenomenon meant, only she had never, ever expected to see it happen with her own eyes. But what witch wakes up one morning knowing she's about to live through history in the making?
"Are we under some kind of legendary rank delusion?"
Alder wondered aloud next to her. The bard and even Kostel and her guards were next to Flavie, watching how a dungeon lord and two heroes, who were under no mind control or anything of the sort, teamed up against a third.
"If we are, don't dispel it,"
Flavie whispered. For all her life, the world had operated under certain rules. If you killed a dangerous creature, you got experience points. You could bend objectivity's rules at your own risk, but never break them outright. A hero is the natural enemy of a dungeon lord. Should they meet, one of them would be destroyed. What Ed had done tonight had never happened. She didn't need to check with Alder to know that. Not only had the cleric practically brought Ed back from the gates of death, he had gotten up as if he had expected it, as if the cleric and the fighter had set this up with him beforehand. She didn't know if that was true. Hadn't Ed mentioned that those three were his old team? It was hard to tell. All heroes looked alike. But she sure as hell knew what it would seem like to the people watching along with her. The cleric had stacked so many high-leveled spells on the dungeon lord that, for their duration, he was inhuman. The fight against the rogue became a blur of movement and deadly clashes that would have killed a non-enhanced man several times over. Flavie could barely follow the seemingly uninterrupted flow of attacks and parries and counterattacks, but she could almost feel each strike rattling her body.
"This is impossible,"
young Ivan said, his voice shaking. He gave the sky a frightened look.
"What in the god's name is going on? Is the world ending? Are Heron and the old demons coming back to devour us?"
"Get a grip, kid,"
Kostel said without taking her gaze from the fight.
"And move back! You're obstructing my view!"
"That's what the sky looks like when an area is saturated with heroic ranked, and above, scrying spells,"
Flavie said quietly.
"In other words, everyone who can afford to hire a diviner is watching this fight go down. King Varen, the Militant Church, most dungeon lords in the regions. Everyone who is someone, and a fair share of nobodies too. Probably even some gods. Those who care about human affairs, at least."
She placed a hand on Alder's shoulder.
"That checkered pattern is proof that we're witnessing history," the bard said. "Every appearance goes straight into bardic annals. It was visible during the final stand of Archlord Everbleed, and during Sephar's punishment, and the last battle between Numerios and Lord Colfair. And now we're here to see it. Flavie, all bards would kill for a chance like this."
"Well, I don't get what has everyone so rattled,"
said Kostel, frowning.
"Dungeon lords kill heroes all the time. Without help, even.
But Ed's convinced two of them to switch sides,
Levy exclaimed.
Don't you see what it means? The heroes are no longer the unrelenting killing machines they were. Now the Inquisition won't know if they can trust the others.
Well,
Costell said,
for killing machines, they are certainly struggling to bring down a lone hero.
Levy frowned and was about to tell the woman something biting when she realized Costell was actually right. In fact, Levy saw how Ed clearly stepped back from a position where he could have beheaded the rogue.
What's going on? Oh!
She turned to Alder and shook him.
He's trying to capture him!
Alder turned and blinked.
What are you talking about?
He's waiting for us, you oaf! Quick, help me drag my stupid dish upstairs before the cleric's bus run out!
She pushed the bard backward into the tower despite his protest. He was clearly too taken aback by the history-in-the-making opportunity to think clearly, and then turned to the guards who had remained in place.
Wetlands! I was talking to you people as well! Move already! We need a drone,
she thought desperately as she rushed for the dish waiting in the middle of the staircase.
Without drones, we can't connect the damn thing to a ley line.
But Ed's drones had vanished, hadn't they? If Levy failed to activate the jamming tower, more heroes would pour into the plaza, and she doubted Ed would manage to convince half of them to join his side this time.
Are there any drones left?
Alder exclaimed as they climbed the last couple steps toward the tarp covering the dish.
Fuck it. I'll do their stupid dance myself,
Levy said as she set her hands on the tarp.
Ugh!
She let out a sharp yelp when she saw one single drone standing behind the dish, trying its best to fulfill the last order given to it by dragging the dish all by its lonesome. The drone took one look at the witch's expression and tried to run from her, but she caught him in a tight hug and held it against her chest as forcefully as she dared without risking unsummoning it.
No one gets near this drone, you hear me?
She yelled at the guards behind. Alder and the guards carried the dish up the stairs as fast as they could, grunting as they went, the weight of the glass threatening to unbalance them with every step they took. Halfway up, they met with Kaga and his monster hunters, who had come down looking for them.
I can't believe you two are still alive! You ran out of spells a while ago!
Kaga told them cheerfully as his men helped the overexerted humans carry the dish up the last floor.
If we survive the night, I'll have to ask my father to make you both into honorary Haganashi.
Kes was waiting for them in the middle of a chamber strewn with Akathunian corpses. Yumiya was tending to a wounded monster hunter at one side, and the marshal had a distant look on her face that she quickly shook off when she saw Levy's expression.
What?
Kes asked her.
Look out the window,
Levy told her. Then she turned to Costell.
Move those corpses out of the way! Hurry!
In seconds, they had rested the dish on the floorboards. Levy set the drone in front of it.
Dance, damn you!
She urged, inches away from the imp's face. The drone gulped and nervously faced the dish. With tentative steps, like someone trying to perform for the first time without any rehearsal, it began to dance.
Faster!
Levy urged it. She was fully aware that everyone else was looking at her like she'd gone insane. She didn't care.
Faster!
The drone danced faster, its pink and purple tunic shaking madly with its frantic movements. Along the room, random debris and trashed furniture evaporated into smoky black tendrils that snaked their way through the air in synchrony with the drone's movements. Most of the smoke disappeared down the floor, but a small tendril surrounded the tarp and consumed it to reveal the carved glass below. The dish stood, the smoke setting it in the correct position. A brass stand grew around the glass like vines, holding it in place. The brass kept growing until it was connected to both the floor and the ceiling. The remaining smoke flew into the glass, setting the engraved runes of its surface alight with raw energy. The drone's dance reached a crescendo, and then the little creature stopped, looking tired. The smoke around the room vanished.
Is that it?
Alder asked.
Is it done?
The drone gave Levy one worried glance and raised its shoulders while nodding over and over.
But nothing is happening,
Kaga pointed out. Levy shook her head, a sense of dread growing in her chest. Her worst fear was coming true in front of her eyes. She had failed.
Something is wrong,
she said.
The jamming device didn't activate. It should have done so by now.
She covered her mouth with her hands and took several frantic breaths.
Oh, gods! Someone needs to tell Ed!
As Ed and Lisa's cleric squared against Rylan Silverblade for another round, the Dungeon Lord shifted his gaze to the inside of the tower, moving from one view to the other in constant flashes. He needed to coordinate his attack perfectly with the jamming tower's activation. At the moment, he spotted Levy and Alder and a few others carrying the dish upstairs. Rylan Silverblade dashed at him and attempted an eviscerate, but Ed stepped back just as Lisa got in the way of the rogue. The blade stopped just an inch away from the elven cleric's belly. At the same time, Ed circled around her and hacked at Rylan's helmet in a shower of arcane sparks. Both rogue and dungeon lord rained blows on each other, trying to do as much damage through their enchanted defenses and buffs as possible. Ed's body screamed with exertion as he overused improved reflexes just to keep up with the rogue's speed. Every once in a while, he managed to steal another rank of endurance from the hero, but Ed burned through the extra energy just as fast, which only meant that both of them were slowing down at about the same time. Except that Ed could feel Lisa's buffs on him starting to run out. With every strike and every parry, he grew weaker. The weight of his sword was growing to the point it felt like he was swinging a thick piece of wood, his shoulders, back, and arms screaming with the effort of every slash. Even his fingers were cramping up.
"Eldritch Edge!"
he said, restarting the spell whose duration had just ended. It was time to end the fight. Ed switched to a view of the tower. He saw his drone dancing atop, with Levy shouting something at it, probably encouraging and cheering it on. The sky above had turned to an impossible checkered pattern, but Ed's mind shoved that detail away, all his focus pouring into the battle.
"That's my cue," Ed thought, gritting his teeth.
He locked blades with Rylan Silverblade, kneed the rogue in the belly, and struck his broken face with his elbow. Rylan stepped back, otherwise undamaged, and renewed the attack, forcing Ed backward, pushing his sword away with sudden ease. Ed roared as a red line appeared on his leg right in the open space between his armor's plates. Rylan circled him like a bird of prey, but Lisa appeared to his side, canceling his attack and forcing him to reposition. Ed shifted his weight to his good leg and rested his back against the cleric's, defending against a flurry of blows so fast and savage that each successful parry threatened to tear his shoulder out of its socket. His sword was a nicked, dulled mess, and any second now, Rylan would slap it out of his cramping hands.
"Now or never, Lisa!"
he yelled, as the rogue's scimitars glowed purple. Ed and the cleric circled each other and switched positions, with Ed facing the open plaza and Lisa facing the incoming rogue. She rushed at the rogue, preparing a spell as she did so. Right at that moment, Rylan Silverblade activated Shadow Strike again. The rogue disappeared and then flashed back into existence in the space between Ed and Lisa, several inches off the ground, scimitars at the ready for a downward slash that Ed wouldn't be able to block this time. Instead, the Dungeon Lord had already turned. He knew exactly where the rogue would appear, after all, and had planted both feet firmly on the ground, ignoring the screams of agony of his wounded leg. He held his sword with both hands close to his body, tip aimed right at the rogue's gut. More of a spear than a sword. For an instant, it was as if the world had frozen, with the rogue soaring toward Ed, scimitars crackling with power, and the dungeon lord staring him down, mouth frozen in a roar to urge his body into one last surge of strength. Then Lisa turned back and released her spell. The storm wind caught Rylan Silverblade from the back while he was still in the air and threw him forward with terrible violence like a leaf in a hurricane. Ed fought against the powerful wind to remain in position, back bent forward, sword at the ready, trusting in his own weight and the weight of his armor to keep him in place. Through his improved reflexes, he saw the rogue fly toward him at impossible speed right as the Dungeon Lord's vision became an exhausted shade of red. Ed thrust his sword with all his strength, and for an instant felt a terrible resistance as Rylan Silverblade's enchanted leather armor tried to prevent the attack. And then a magical aftershock surrounded the rogue and the Dungeon Lord when the armor gave and the flaming sword bit deep into the hero's gut, piercing all the way to the back and then out. Ed buried the sword to the hilt, and then the rogue was upon him, embracing him as if they were lovers. They clashed, and Lisa's wind dragged them both through a confusing mess of steel,
and Ed could sense how the rogue's inner workings tried to teleport him away just as the anti-magic runes in his sword flared to life with cold, blue light. One more second, and the self-destruct mechanism would trigger with Ed right next to it. And there was no healing magic that could bring him back from being blown to pieces.
"We need to leave,"
Kes urged, grabbing at Levy from behind and trying to drag her away from the dish. Tears were streaming from the witch's face.
"No, you don't understand,"
she exclaimed.
"I built this. Everyone's counting on me."
"It's not your fault,"
Kes told her. Since when was Levy so stalwart? Desperation seemed to have multiplied the woman's strength because Kes was having trouble pulling her away.
"You did your best, but now we need to evacuate the city before the rest of the heroes arrive."
One more second and she'd just have to knock the witch out.
"Damn it! I built it right! I know I did!"
"Levy!"
The witch elbowed Kes in the gut. Kes blinked, more surprised than hurt, and then Levy wriggled free. She rushed the dish, her face contorted in a paroxysm of pure unbridled rage and agonizing despair. She began to kick at the glass so hard that the brass stand shook with each strike.
"I built you right!"
Kes grimaced. Her hands were about to close on the witch's shoulders when, back in the metaphysical realm where the drones had connected the energy of the ley line to the essence of the jamming device, something clicked loose and fell into place. In a fraction of a second so small that it would have made the silence between a hummingbird's heartbeat seem like hours, the jamming dish went from being inert glass to the glowing white eye of an angry god. The world turned to a white flash, and Kes wanted to scream in surprise, but before her brain could even signal for her mouth to open, a magical burst exploded in a growing sphere out of the glowing eye, traveled through Kes and past her with such speed that she felt it in her bone marrow, and then she was lifted off of her feet and thrown all the way across the room against the solid wall, only by some miracle missing the window, forcing all air out of her lungs and making her see stars. It was only at that point that she managed to finish her surprised scream, but it came out more like a muffled groan. Then Levy's slender form struck against her, and then the marshal was out cold. Just as Kes's feet were leaving the ground at the start of her inexorable path toward the wall, the burst had already surrounded the entirety of Undercity in a translucent sphere that saturated the air with the smell of ozone and blocked all incoming magical signals of a certain frequency. All over the world, diviners shook their scrying devices as the sudden influx of static dulled their view. Every glass window in the city exploded into glinting dust beneath the twin moons. Every summoned creature was vanished back to its realm, and all as one, every hero in Undercity collapsed, immobile, spasming as their rudimentary brains demanded input that wasn't arriving. They all either teleported out or self-destructed. All but one. Empress Laurel glanced at the sky, feeling her insides churn with the influx of magic saturating the city. Underneath her, Karmic and Pris stopped as they entered the escape tunnel with the cart full of survivors waiting for them. The thieves exchanged glances filled with wonder. Kleck and Tulip led a charge against the wizard that had the Spider Riders and Oscor's smugglers in their sights, but Tulip stopped short as the wizard threw its arms up and disappeared in a flash. Kleck lowered his spear, his body trembling from terror and adrenaline, and glanced backward at the distant plaza with the black tower pointing up like a finger challenging the gods. Bartender Max opened the cellar's trapdoor to the burnt, still-smoking ruin of the Galleon's Folly, and contemplated the checkered pattern of the sky above. A small, lingering flame licked the hairy man's leg, but it did no damage, and he seemed not to notice. The bartender smiled to himself and went back under his cellar. After she'd circled the zone of the forest where she'd last seen the purple mist of the vampire, Alvedra almost fell out of her griffin when she saw the city light up like a star for an instant. And she suddenly realized with growing dread that she'd made a terrible mistake by thinking that the heroes and her fellow inquisitors had the situation handled back there. Moments later, she'd sent Galtia a message with the haunt's general location and flown back to Undercity. But by then, it was too late. Undercity had rallied,
bloodied but very much alive and angry, against the Inquisition. Alvidra returned to a routing unit of the militant church's survivors escaping from a suddenly hostile city and no heroic support. She tried to reach the charcoal tower with her griffin again, on her own, but it was so heavily defended by then that the sky lit up around her with runes and arrows, forcing her to retreat.
"We gave him a city,"
she thought bleakly. Hours later, as she stepped along with her defeated inquisitors through Mulesia's magical circle, it was the first time in her lifetime that the Inquisition was forced to abandon a territory.
"Oh, gods above, what have we done?"
All the way across the world, King Varen rose from his chair, which threw the court's scrying ball off the table and shattered it, much to his diviner's chagrin.
"Gather our armies," the king told the knight general next to him.
And in Lotia and the Netherworld, both demon regents and dungeon lords alike rose with blazing eyes as their scrying devices showed Lord Edward Wright struggle to his feet, covered in wounds, armor so dented it was barely recognizable, cape torn to shreds and more brown than green, the last dredges of the cleric's buffs fleeing from his body in trails of smoke. His expression turned inscrutable as he regarded the broken shape of the rogue at his feet, the last remaining hero in the city, and the first one in history to be in possession of the Dark Aligned. For a single instant, then, as his evil eye flared, Lord Wright seemed to gaze straight at the scrying device. But by then, few dungeon lords were still paying attention. Most were already up and gathering their seconds in command with greedy grins flashing across their faces. "Get me that tower blueprint and that hero," they told their minions, "no matter the cost."
"You have gained 235 experience points. Your attributes have increased. Brawn plus one, endurance plus one, spirit plus one. Your skills have increased. Melee plus two, dungeon engineering plus two, combat casting plus two, leadership plus five. Your aura's energy expenditure has been reduced. There are new talent advancement options for you. There are new dungeon upgrades available for research. The haunt's level threat has grown enough for your enemies to know its approximate location."
Chapter 31. Ancient Traditions. Connection lost. Reconnecting. Reconnecting. Ivalice Online crashed. Lisa slowly took her hands away from the keyboard. That had been intense. Probably the hardest fight she'd ever faced. How many IO players could boast that they'd taken out another player by using a boss to do the dirty work for them?
And as a healer.
Her forum account was already lighting up with notifications from hundreds of threads mentioning her username as players everywhere lost their minds because of her feat. A flame war started, with people split into sides calling Mark and Lisa either traitorous bitches or master team killers worthy of admiration. There was even talk of getting her account banned. Lisa didn't care. After tonight, she suspected she'd milked Ivalice Online out of everything it had to offer her. And that was fine. Games were meant to be finished. There was a pang of nostalgia in her chest, as if she was closing a chapter in her life. And, in a way, she was. At the very least, she wouldn't bother going back to Laser Shark in the morning. And neither would Mark. She had no savings, and rent would soon be due. But she'd figure something out. Hell, she knew all there was to know about computer repair. Perhaps Mark and her could come up with something. Laser Shark could use some competition. They'd need a logo. Something with neon, of course. It was just her aesthetic. Lisa grinned, feeling at peace and comfortably tired. The shadows in the corners of her home seemed to be just that. Shadows. There was nothing threatening about them. Before closing the web browser, she posted on the forums enough to fan the flame war and make it last a couple more days. And as a final goodbye, she politely requested that the forum moderators go choke on a dick, then deleted her own account before they could. Diana came home soon after, announced by her unsteady footsteps.
Lisa's sister fumbled outside for her keys while rambling happily, then fought with the lock for a minute until she managed to get the door open and step inside, the reek of vodka inundating the apartment. Diana had her hair strewn with broken branches and dry leaves and was holding a stop sign in one arm and some random guy in the other. The random guy looked around the apartment in a haze and smiled like an idiot.
"Hey, sis,"
Diana called.
"We'll be right over there, all right?" "All right."
The two of them stumbled their way toward the couch, but then Diana stopped and turned to face Lisa, raising her eyebrows with curiosity.
"What?"
Lisa asked her, grinning.
"Nothing. It's just, I haven't seen you smile like that in a while. What happened? Did your boss stick his head in a wood chipper?"
Lisa laughed and shrugged.
"Just some dumb thing, really. I'll tell you in the morning, okay?"
Diana pointed the stop sign at her and smiled.
"Sure. Just do it quietly, please. I suspect this hangover is going to be one to remember."
As she packed her stuff to give her sister some privacy, Lisa found the black calling card at the bottom of the desk drawer. She gave it a curious once-over. For a second, she wondered.
Behind her, the darkness loomed, eager, waiting for a decision.
Lisa tossed the card in the trash. Whatever it was offering, she wasn't looking for. All she wanted was a quiet, happy life with her computers, her family, and her friends. Wherever Ed was, she hoped he could find, one day, his own version of happiness. Lisa's dreams went back to normal from then on. A tall gentleman dressed in a tailored black suit strolled into the Laser Shark store. The place was chaotic, with a dozen customers standing angrily in front of the counter where a young, blonde manager frantically attempted to do the work of several employees at once. Charon smiled. It seemed that Mark and Lisa hadn't been the only ones to quit on Ryan. From what the boatman knew of human affairs, this was nothing unusual. Mortals were often emboldened by the meaningful actions of their peers, and once the first one was brave enough to act, others found it easy to follow in the individual's footsteps. The boatman whistled a happy tune while he walked around the store. In the end, Lisa had rejected the call of the dark. That happened sometimes. Contrary to popular belief, the dark god Murmur did not force anyone to join his ranks. He didn't need to. In all realities, Ivalice and Earth and beyond, there would be mortals that, for one reason or another, weren't satisfied with their lot in life. Those who desired power did so for many reasons. Ambition, revenge, despair, boredom, genuine good intentions. It was all the same to Charon when he was summoned. The dark preyed on the men and women who desired more, who gazed at the starry sky above in challenge, or fell to their knees and despaired, and those who stared at the shadows of a dark corner in an empty house and wondered. And every time, Charon would be there, with a lipless smile full of teeth, and his hand extended with a silent offer. Most would deny him, but enough would take the hand that was offered. That was the way it had always been, and would always be. Back behind the counter, Ryan's lips curled in a frown of disgust. He'd spent a sour night alone in his big, cold house, plagued with anger and hatred and loneliness. The customers could sense his contempt and answered it tenfold, creating a feedback loop of hatred that Charon could taste. It was delicious. To him, the fact that Murmur's crazed plays always turned out to be, from the perspective of both the Dark One's enemies and allies, indistinguishable from mastermind plans that spanned generations or eons, had taught Charon much about how the world really worked. How insane everything was, and the importance of carving himself a little piece of the cake and enjoying the fireworks while reality itself collapsed around him. Because entropy always won in the end, but the end was still rather far away. In other words, being a bit resentful against a mortal was fine, so long as it was fun. And Edward Wright could use being taken down a peg. As Murmur's envoy,
Charon had some leeway in how he accomplished his tasks. The Dark One wanted a new Dungeon Lord to replace Yraz. He also wanted more summoned Dungeon Lords from Earth, since the first one had been such a success. He'd decided that having a close friend submit to the same pact Ed had would create an interesting situation while, at the same time, advancing the cause of the Dark by reinforcing its hold in Steravos. But Lisa had refused. Well, Charon could work with that. What possible choice could he make that would keep Murmur entertained, while at the same time pissing off Charon's best friend? Good old, moody Edward Wright. The boatman chuckled darkly to himself as he strolled toward the counter. He had just the right person in mind. The night in Hoya Forest was full of stars, with the air brimming with the noises of activity coming from the haunt and its surroundings. Ed sat alone on a tree stump, away from everyone else. He was dressed in a simple linen tunic to avoid attracting undue attention. Oftentimes, he found it refreshing to step out of the role of the Dungeon Lord and walk around the place he'd built along with his friends, simply watching the way people went about their lives. Lately, there was much to be seen. Ed was finding it harder and harder to keep up with everyone's names, and sometimes people just showed up. Like that peculiar halfling monk that was training a score of Haga Anashi in his seemingly chaotic style of martial arts under the gaze of the moons. Ed had no idea where the hell the halfling had come from, but the Kuftar seemed happy to have him around, and at this point it'd be awkward if Ed went up and asked him who the hell he was. So the Dungeon Lord just let them be. A bit of distraction from their mourning of the late Kagelshire would do them well. Above Ed, Hoya's jamming tower rose like a black spire, the crown jewel of the surrounding circle of scrambling towers that hid the haunt from prying eyes. Next to the market outside the dungeon's entrance and closest to Ed's tree stump was the railway nexus, a zone where the tunnels all across the countryside, Hoya and Undercity, connected together. In a few years, the nexus would be the heart of a new city, and the dungeon would be its palace. If they lived that long, of course. People came and went out of the nexus at all hours. There were mercenaries from the netherworld, thieves, and smugglers, as well as emissaries from other dungeon lords trying to offer lavish gifts, or gruesome threats, in exchange for the jamming tower's blueprints or a look at the captured hero hidden at the bottom of the haunt. Ed had minor demons manning the dungeons sprouting out in the countryside to keep the Inquisitors as far away from the haunt as possible. Along with the demons were wizards and enchantresses, Naga and Kuftar, roving bands of werewolves, elves and gnomes and dwarves, and the list went on. Monster hunters entered the Nexus, dragging sturdy carriages loaded with iron cages that transported monsters, oozes, hell chickens, man-eating plants, zombies, and skeletons. Alongside them, the citizens of the haunt. The haunted, as they had taken to calling themselves of late, mingled and bartered, argued and joked and exchanged gossip. Andrina and her goat were talking with a gnome witch doctor about exotic herbal remedies. Fjorce and Ivona chatted with a traveling dwarven blacksmith about the carts and other machinery from the mountains. Zachary and a stern-looking elf argued, of course, about religion. Most of those travelers had just appeared one day, and their numbers kept growing even as some left and others stayed. Ed hadn't turned them away. He had simply had Kes come up with new security protocols in case someone was a spy. Now that the haunt's location wasn't exactly a secret, he guessed word had traveled far, and there were always people in the world that were at home in a place like the haunt more than in normal society. There was the petty criminal and the eccentric, yes, but also the dreamer and the rebel. Along with mercenaries came traveling troops of fearless actors that performed in both Elytra and the Netherworld, itinerant bards and their shaggier cousins, the Skalds from the Frozen North. The secret was in the railway. There was always some sort of interaction between a dungeon and its neighbors, and Ed had made sure the interaction was mostly positive, or at least as not negative as such a thing could be. So far, only three Inquisitors had managed to sneak inside the haunt by pretending to be friendly travelers, but they had been easily discovered through Kes's safety measures,
Ed smiled as his haunt bubbled with life around him. At that moment, despite the many dangers the future held for him and his friends, he was content. Someone sat next to him on the tree stump.
"Do you mind having some company, Lord Ed?"
Kleck asked quietly, following Ed's gaze with the same look of wonder in the man's eyes.
"You seemed a bit lonely from afar, but now I realize I got the wrong impression."
"Your company is always welcome, Kleck," Ed told his friend. "To tell you the truth, I came here to take my mind off of tomorrow's meeting. I've been practicing with Alder and Levy for a while. Even Yarlin's going to play a part."
"What's so hard about a meeting?"
Kleck asked, his ears perking up with curiosity.
"Compared to fighting the heroes, talk must be easy for you."
Ed smiled and shrugged.
"Well, I'm going to face most of Undercity's influential men, and I'm going to try to convince them that I'll do whatever is necessary for everyone's survival, but for entirely the wrong reasons."
Kleck cocked his head.
"Why?"
"Because. See, they expect to meet a dungeon lord tonight. They have certain expectations."
Ed thought of Gallio and Alvedra, and all the Inquisitors Ed himself had killed during the battle for Undercity.
"I've learned that when you challenge the way people view the world, they tend to react strongly."
He paused and looked at the black jamming tower behind them.
"And if I am to unite these people so we may stand together, then I need to give them what they need."
"So you'll become the dungeon lord they expect you to be?"
"Oh, absolutely not," Ed said. "Not at all. More like, I hope to put on a very convincing act. Here's the thing, Kleck. Dungeon lords are much weaker than people think."
He gestured at the Nexus, the market, and the dungeon's entrance.
"Ignoring all the flashy powers and the glowing eyes and the enchanted weapons, if someone takes a knife to my neck, all I've built is gone. Just like that."
Ed snapped his fingers.
"That will never happen with me around."
"I know," Ed said with a small grin. "But even then, someday we'll both get old, and then we'll die. And even if Levy raises us as her undead servants, eventually the three of us will pass anyway. It's life, and it happens to everyone. But I love the haunt, and I'd do anything to have the certainty it will go on once I'm gone. The packs and the mantle magic will disappear when I do. That's why being just a dungeon lord is not enough. Really, the mantle is nothing more than a disposable weapon of war for the dark. I don't think the dungeons were ever meant to last. But men build families and kingdoms that outlast the most ancient dungeon, and they do it without any magic. Or at least, not the kind that's measured with experience points. I hope to harness a tiny bit of that magic one day. Lord Wraith may not be able to, but perhaps Ed of the Haunt may."
Kleck sat in silence, his chin resting on his hands as he considered Ed's words.
"So, you don't intend to leave us anytime soon?"
"Never. My dream is for the Haunt to keep the best parts of me, and that the worst parts are lost forever after I'm gone."
Very slowly, Kleck nodded. Both man and Batblin sat in silence for a long time, people gazing. After a while, Ed took out a small package from his pocket.
"You know what?" he told his friend. "I realize that I've barely played any games at all since I arrived in Ivalis. Sure, I've had fun, but almost always the main purpose was to enhance my dungeon. I rarely play for the sake of playing anymore."
He showed Kleck the package. It was a deck of cards.
"I had these made the way we play them on Earth. Would you like for me to teach you a couple of games I played on my home world?"
The Batblin's ears perked up.
"Yes,"
he said.
"I'd like that very much."
Alfred the Sly, the newly appointed Grand Master of Undercity's Thieves Guild, wearily climbed the steps of the Charcoal Tower while wondering to himself about the speed at which life could change without warning. To start with, he'd never in his life expected to wear the Grand Master's overcoat, and he certainly hadn't expected to find himself stepping on the black and white floorboards of the former headquarters of the Assassin's Guild. A couple months after the battle for Undercity, Alfred's wounds still hurt, despite the healer's best attempts at easing his many aches. He didn't complain. Not aloud, at least. The fact that he had stayed in the burning guild house instead of running like most thieves, facing many heroes on his own and winning, had earned the admiration of his peers and contributed greatly to his new position. Alfred had simply forgotten to mention how he'd only stayed because he was too terrified to run, and those heroes he'd fought were low-level survivors trying to hide and heal in the basement where he had already been hiding. He'd killed them right as they were drinking their potions. Small details like that were best kept out of the bardic annals. Although that asshole Karmic kept giving him funny looks every time they passed each other in the corridors of the new guild house. The guildmaster rested against a wall to catch his breath. Outside the window, the city was at once the same as always and utterly unrecognizable. People headed out on their way to work, priests, sailors, witch doctors, whores, bakers, shoemakers, ranchers, farmers, builders, dishonest merchants and hard-working thieves, and so on and on. Some walked past the rubble of buildings that the drones hadn't yet gotten through to clearing, and others intentionally avoided the streets where they'd lost friends or family members. New taverns sprouted up where others had burned down, and a new clientele heeded the call of the ale. Fresh faces that would in time become known as the same old regulars. In the ports, the merchant ships had run away and never returned. The Heligian Navy blocked all routes to Undercity. Instead of an empty harbor, though, the black flags of pirates and smugglers grew tall like a forest of sails swaying gently with the salty breeze. Ask barkeep Max, and he'd regale you with rumors of a pirate queen that had risen from the hidden islands of the east, claiming to have the blood of the royal family coursing through her veins, and challenging the rule of both Dungeon Lord and Heligians alike. If you asked the newly risen bandit king under the Galtian Mountains, he'd laugh in your face, telling you the pirate queen has as much royal blood in her veins as his horse. He was the true secret heir to the Staravosi throne. Then he'd rob you naked and beat you to a bloody pulp. The coasts of Staravos brimmed with pirates and bandits like a disease sensing weakness in the defenses of the militant church's occupation. All over Staravos, rebellions brewed and flared as tales of a city surrounded by untamed dungeons reached and emboldened the ears of men and women that recalled the times when their country had been free. Inquisitors marched all across the countryside, trying to halt the spread of the dungeons and their jamming towers, and in Haligis, the militant armies gathered. Free. It was such a strange concept to Alfred. The sky was the same color as always. The people were the same. But a keen eye could pinpoint many differences in the way normal life was conducted. Necromancers walked freely down the streets, their animated skeletons carrying their scrolls around. Cults that had spent their lives hidden in the sewers or the catacombs now erected temples to their tentacled gods right next to altars of Oinus and Hogbus. There was word of a vampire that hunted slavers. Batblins and Kuftar patrolled the avenues, proudly wearing the colors of the haunt. And at night, if you paid attention, perhaps you could hear the blood-curdling bawk of a hell chicken that had so far managed to avoid capture by the monster hunters. It was the dawn of a new city, and it was also just another day. Life would never be the same, yet life went on, same as always. Alfred sighed and hurried up the last set of stairs. The reason he was in such a pensive mood was because he was trying to distract himself from the statues that lined the halls of the charcoal tower. They had taught him far more about horned spider sexuality than he had had any desire to ever know. He arrived at the doors of the palatial seat where the Dungeon Lord held court. This was not the seat of Undercity, of course. The real one was said to lie under the undead-infested catacombs, surrounded by dangers and secrets that the Dungeon Lord and his minions had only just begun to crack. The Kuftar guards opened the doors for Alfred, and he stepped into a chamber just a floor below the jamming device. There was a magical circle drawn in silver lines across the floor, and the air was charged with anti-scrying spells and other enchantments. A richly carved table large enough for a feast filled the center of the room, with
with a curtain of water flowing down the wall behind the Dungeon Lord's chair opposite the entrance and disappearing inside a delicate model of Undercity itself, a small part of the fountain water becoming the city's canal.
"Grandmaster Alfred," the Dungeon Lord greeted him cordially, "we were waiting for your arrival."
He gave a wide, sweeping gesture to include the men and women sitting at the table with him. There was a certain regal arrogance to the way Lord Edward Wright conducted himself, the kind present in men who had faced certain death and impossible odds and come up victorious. He was lean and spry with all the strength of youth still in his body, but his visage was grim and distant in a way that conveyed a degree of truth to certain rumors about his capacity to observe everything and everyone in his city at any time. His pupils shone with faint circles of eldritch green light. His evil eye deactivated less and less as time went by, and now it was rarely completely off. His black hair fell over the fur of his ebony cloak, and he wore a fitted crimson vest over a light, silky gray gambeson that was said to be made out of spiderweb. The silver rings on his charred black hand clinked together as he rapped distractedly on the table. Much was said in Undercity about the mysterious man that had expelled the Inquisition and, depending on who you asked, either saved the city or condemned it in the first place. Rumors were, the insects and tiny critters of the city spoke directly to him, whispering unearthed secrets and naming those who opposed his rule. He could change bodies like a noblewoman changed gowns, and could walk through walls and make the livestock of his enemies fall ill with warts at the point of a finger. It was said that at midnight, the top of the charcoal tower would glow blood red as the Dungeon Lord held court with demons from the Netherworld and djinns from Plekth, and that if you listened carefully, you could hear the mad laughter of his witches as they conducted seances in the catacombs of the city. As a thief, Alfred knew better than to heed most rumors. If he thought about it, Lord Wright looked like he could use some sleep.
"My apologies for the delay," Alfred said. "A hell chicken snuck into the new guild house last night and ate all our salted meat reserves. We managed to put it down, but it was difficult."
The thief shuddered at the memory. Lord Wright frowned. "Chief Kaga insists his monster hunters found all their nests already. I have no idea how they keep popping up."
"I swear the damn creatures are getting smarter and craftier the more we hunt them," said Grandmaster Balgid of the Mercer's Guild. "At least they don't know how to work door handles. Yet."
Alfred took a look around the table. Everyone who was someone in Undercity had attended tonight's summons. Next to Wright were most of his closest minions, except for the Marshal, who was rumored to be off on a diplomatic mission to a distant land. Around Alfred were the leaders or elected representatives of most of the city's associations, noble families, banks, guilds, trading companies, and leagues. The Mercers, the Brewers, the Smugglers, even the Pirates, the Watch, the Church of Oinus, and the Cult of Zethron the Many-Tentacled, the Necromancers, and a couple more. The Acathunian Assassins, though, were missing. They hadn't shown their faces much since they'd tried to increase their standing with the Dungeon Lord by gifting him a cadre of Batblin slaves. Wright apparently favored human slaves, however, because he'd reacted by feeding the Acathunian slavers to his pet vampire. In any case, Alfred had avoided offering lavish gifts to the Dungeon Lord until he became more certain of his preferences. Grandmaster Brewer, a man with a red, button-like nose, coughed politely.
"Your execrableness, every man of decency is here, as well as our less savory guests."
Brewer gave Alfred a nasty sideways glance.
"Perhaps you may now shed some light on the reason behind our meeting. Why are we here?"
Most of the merchants and noble houses weren't friends with the Thieves Guild, for rather self-explanatory reasons. Except the Mercers, of course. Alfred had once bought a cashmere jacket from them. Once. To this day, he still wondered who the real professional thieves were.
"It certainly can't be because of your charming personality," Alfred told the brewer. "When was the last time you took a bath, Heinek?"
Heinek's nose reddened a bit more, and he gestured as if to stand.
"Gentlemen," Lord Wright said, raising his voice just enough to be heard past the scraping of the chair, Behave. Don't make me use the trap door.
A few laughed. Grandmaster Hynek seemed dubious for a second, as if he was considering calling the bluff. Then he sat back down and ignored Alfred. Wright nodded.
Good.
Chronicler Alder handed him a long scroll that seemed decades old.
I summoned you here to